Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. We're glad you're here for today's program, and of course, we welcome any new Commonwealth Club members. If you're not a member, today's a great day to join. I'd also like to quickly tell you about some upcoming San Francisco programs. Tomorrow, Art Garfunkel will be at the club. We'll be holding that at the Castro Theater. On October 18th, Anne-Marie Slaughter will be here. October 31st, Steve Forbes returns to the Commonwealth Club. And on November 17th, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell will be at the club, and we'll see if he agrees with Charlie on what he says today. So there are question cards spread throughout the room. Please write down some questions. They'll be collected and given to me, and I'll try to work in as many of those questions as we can. And finally, we wish to remind you that we have copies of Charlie Sykes' new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, on sale, and we'll be doing book signing right outside of this room after this program. So let us begin. Do we not have a gavel today? Oh, really? Okay. Well, good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. The club is online at commonwealthclub.org, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I'm John Zipperer, the club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, host of its week-to-week political roundtable series, and your moderator for today. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Charlie Sykes. He's the author of 8 books on current affairs and education, including his new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. For years, he was the number one conservative talk radio host in the state of Wisconsin. His past books have offered critiques of higher education, such as 1989's Prof Scam. He has written about politics and social criticism, such as The End of Privacy in 1999 and A Nation of Moochers in 2013. Now, his latest book builds on critiques he has made of the new populist movement that has captured the Republican Party and much of the conservative movement, leading him to wonder what happened to the party of Reagan and the movement dedicated to conservative ideas and ideals. Let's learn what he found in his exploration. Please welcome Mr. Charlie Sykes. So let's begin with a comment you made this past weekend on CNN. You said that President Donald Trump was, quote, unstable, unquote. The only person who talks tougher about the president seems to be Rex Tillerson. But tell us about what was behind that comment and what it means to have a president you consider to be unstable.
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation to come here and discuss all this. I was responding to the question from the host who was asking me about what Senator Bob Corker had said. And he said, do you think the president is stable? And I said, no, and I never have, going back from the beginning, that nothing that we're seeing right now should come as a surprise to anybody who was paying attention. And, you know, we can talk about this a little bit later, but you know, as a never-Trump conservative, very, very early on, I said, look, you know, Donald Trump is clearly and manifestly unfit to be the president of the United States, whatever your ideology. Mm-hmm. You know, he is a fraud, a serial liar who mocks the disabled and women, you know, an erratic narcissist with the vocabulary of an emotionally, you know, unstable 9-year-old. And I thought it was a bad idea to give him control of the FBI, the CIA, and the nuclear codes. My response to that was, I'm not sure that there's any revelation that we're getting now, mm-hmm. except for people who believe that somehow he was going to pivot, that he would grow into the office of the presidency, which I think was always a delusion.
That is tempting, as I'm going to take the opportunity. When Senator Dianne Feinstein was at the Commonwealth Club recently, she actually ventured there, and she said there could still be the possibility that he could mature, that he could become a good president yet. What's your reaction to that?
Oh, I disagree with her. I mean, with all due respect, I think that Senator Feinstein was letting her optimism get ahead of the reality that we're seeing here. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is 70 years old. He's not going to change. He's not going to grow. He's not showing any desire to grow or change. And I think that while I understand the desire to look for the best in everyone and the desire to look for possible grounds for future compromise reaching across party lines,
sure.
I do think that, you know, part of the reality check is that Donald Trump is what he is. He is has had numerous opportunities to grow. I mean, today, even as we're sitting here right now, the President of the United States, with all the crises around the world and facing the country, is taking to Twitter to mock the height of a United States senator. I just try to get you grasp that you look at this and you remember, I remember what this felt like when I was in sixth grade on the playground. But we're not on the playground. We're talking about the President of the United States. So I understand that Senator Feinstein thinks that there's a possibility that he could somehow become an effective president, but Donald Trump is not going to become anyone other than Donald Trump.
Well, let's go back a bit in time and tell us how you came to this view of Donald Trump. Many people outside of Wisconsin became aware of your views during the Republican presidential primary when Trump was a call-in guest to your show. Had a very, what became a very quickly a very famous conversation with you. Take us back there and tell us what happened and as much as you can, why it happened, why he didn't seem prepared for this.
No, he wasn't. And this is why I was surprised. I had a show we began every morning at 8:30, and my producer told me that Donald Trump was going to call in at 8:30. And at 8:29, I didn't think he was going to call in. I didn't, because if he would have spent 10 seconds looking at my Twitter feed, he would have known that I was never Trump. I had been talking about Donald Trump from the moment he came down the golden escalator and announced for president. I think I'd made my feelings manifestly clear. I think they showed up in the polls in Wisconsin. So I did not expect that he was going to call in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting that you would ask me about that today when the president's, you know, tweeting about the height of somebody, because
sure.
the first thing that I wanted to talk to him about was that he was putting out tweets that were mocking the appearance of his opponent's wife. He was making fun of Ted Cruz's wife's looks. And I thought this was a good opportunity for him coming into Wisconsin, where we valued certain levels of civility, to apologize for that or commit to stop doing it. And one of the lines I used, you know, with him was, "You are running for the office once held by Abraham Lincoln." And, you know, is there some different level of behavior? And of course, his response to me was, "Well, he started it," which is actually how we got to the playground.
Right.
I said, "Well, you know, why are you mocking, you know, your opponents? You know, what? Well, you know, grown men don't make fun of other men's wives' looks." So, "Well, he started it." So, "Well, that's what I expect from the playground. That's what I expect. You're running for president of the United States, Abraham Lincoln's job." And it went downhill from there.
What was the reaction like from your listeners? Were they pleased to see you take him on? Because, again, they must have known your views. Or was there blowback?
Well, no. I mean, in Wisconsin, up until the middle of the year, mm-hmm. I think you had a Republican Party that was willing to see Donald Trump for what he was. And we can talk about this later, the sort of the soul-crushing, disillusioning slog of 2016 for me. But up until that moment, I think they understood that there were so many other choices. I mean, here was a moment where you had a variety of candidates, yeah. not as many by this point. This was March 28th, so we were right before the Wisconsin primary. Most, I think, listeners knew what to expect, even if Donald Trump didn't. And by the way, I did ask Mr. Trump halfway through the interview. I said, "Now, when you called in, did you know that I was never Trump?" And he said, "I did not know that." But he was a good sport about it. So I will give him credit for that. But it was only later, after he had secured the nomination,
yeah.
that I think I was not in sync with the audience any longer.
And you go into this in the book a bit, but also there was a big shift you're seeing, not just in Wisconsin conservatives, but nationally, that shift when you got from the primary to a nominee. Explain a bit more what that was and what reaction did you see among other conservatives, among other conservative leaders?
Well, and I saw this in Wisconsin as well,
mm-hmm.
that you had a lot of conservative look. I mean, literally, I was very active in the conservative movement. I literally knew no elected official and not one other person that I respected who supported Donald Trump up until April. No one. No one in the party supported him. And yet somehow he was securing the nomination. From that moment on, I figured that if you believe that he's fundamentally unfit to be president, that he represented a repudiation of everything you believed, I figured that people would stay there. This was naive on my part. Because what happened was, and I've borrowed this line from Jonah Goldberg from National Review, it was like invasion of the body snatchers. You know, watching one person after another go, well, he's the nominee, I have to support him. It's a binary choice. Mm-hmm. And one after another, they fell into line. One of the things that I did in Wisconsin, we created a thing called the Right Women Awards, where I made it my personal project to encourage women in politics, mm-hmm. conservative women. And we had events where we honored, I would say, almost every significant policymaker, politician, leader, thinker in the state. By the end of this campaign, every single one of those women supported Donald Trump. And what I saw happening was this incredible, I'm going to mix the metaphors here, so I apologize in advance, the gravitational pull of our tribal politics, how intense it is that even if you recognize all the character flaws, all of the other issues, it has become a binary choice, us versus them. And no matter how awful Donald Trump was, Hillary Clinton was worse. She had been demonized for 20 years. And so this pull of, you want to say, partisan polarization, mm-hmm. I think it moved beyond partisan polarization into this tribalism. And so I watched as the party first was beaten and then capitulated and then acquiesced and then enabled Donald Trump, which we have seen really since all of that, with a lot of people that I had known for more than 20 years making decisions that I found quite remarkable.
Now, someone in the audience asks, define what it means to be a conservative today, and that folds into something I wanted to get into as well, which was, define what it means to you to be a conservative. What kind of conservative are you, and how has that, for lack of a better term, brand of conservative changed in the past 20 or 30 years, or has it been the same but the more populist
right.
movement has kind of developed around it? I mean, So first, what kind of a conservative are you?
Well, I would say that the first question is much more complicated. What does it mean to be a conservative?
Sure.
I have no idea anymore, given the era of Trump. That's the short answer to that. That's a real puzzling question anymore. My brand of conservatism apparently was much smaller than I had imagined it to be, which would, focus on limited government, individual freedom, free markets, constitutionalism, personal responsibility, a respect for traditional values, things like that, including civility, but also a certain tradition of respect for our democratic norms. It was common sense based. It was reality based. It was not based on alternative facts. Mm-hmm. It could be distinguished from crackpotism, the fever swamps of the right, which I imagined were fringe elements, which turned out not to be as fringy as I had thought that they were.
Mm-hmm. We were talking before this program about, especially the 1980s and the early 1990s, there was a lot of intellectual ferment among yeah. both Republicans as a party and conservatives as a movement. And, a lot being written, a lot of magazines that were delving into ideas and arguing about ideas and such. That's not the case anymore. And I think when you're talking about how the right lost its mind, that's part of what you're referring to, am I right?
Well, it's very much part of what I was referring to. As you and I were discussing, I might have had a somewhat distorted view because I really thought that there was an intellectual renaissance among conservatives. I mean, you can trace this back to Buckley and the people like Buckley in the 1960s, sure. through the rise, George Will and Charles Krauthammer in the 1970s and beyond, publications like National Review and Commentary, etc. When those ideas were taken very seriously, but as George Will and I had a conversation as I was leaving my radio show, it turned out that we were a much smaller band of brothers and sisters than we thought. that I think that we had this intellectual veneer that turns out to be really pie crust thin over a conservative movement that obviously had different sets of values.
Well, you might not have an answer for this yet, but maybe you know what direction it's going in or what ideas are being talked about. But in fact, again, another person from the audience is, where do conservatives like you go then? I mean, can you change the Republican Party back into what you want it to be? Or do you look for a new home? Or do you stand outside, to steal from William F. Buckley, to stand athwart history and say, no, stop?
Well, we do stand athwart history once again doing it. I describe myself as a contrarian conservative, but the reality is that guys like me were in the wilderness. And I knew after this election we were going to be in the wilderness. What I didn't know that was going to be a really, really small desert island with just a handful of us. I don't know the answer. I don't know where we're going. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a moment at which Trump leaves and we return to the situation that it was before. I think the damage that's going to be done to the movement and to the culture and to our politics is going to last for a very, very long time. I don't know what the future of the Republican Party is going to be. Mm-hmm. The party has shown itself to be more invertebrate than I would have expected. As I say in the book, a Republican Party that was deeply conservative or that actually had fixed principles would never have nominated Donald Trump. A party without fixed principles or one that was open to the kind of nationalist nativism that he represents would have nominated him. If there was going to be a third party, I think that 2016 would have been the perfect opportunity. I think that there would have been that moment where people would say, not Hillary, not Trump, give us another choice. Mm-hmm. The fact that that didn't happen makes me skeptical. But I do think that the Republican Party needs either to be deeply reformed or replaced.
Now, and correct me if I'm wrong, you and a number of other contrarian conservatives voted for the independent conservative in the party, in the race in November.
Evan McMullen.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm actually working with him on, he's got an organization called Stand Up Republic, mm-hmm. which I think is one of those, who knows where it's going to go, but basically, you know, people of goodwill who want to go back to first principles.
Yeah.
We actually believe in the Constitution. We believe in limitations. We are going to push back against the cult of personality, the authoritarianism, the post-factual era. We actually do believe in the rule of law. And so we're a very small organization, as you might expect these days, but I think it might be a seed.
You mentioned William F. Buckley, of course, the giant of conservatism in the 20th century. And in your book, you also recount the role he played kind of cleaning up conservatism, going to the fringe and banning it, out pushing it out, the John Birchers, the anti-Semites and such. Is there anyone who could do that, either an individual or an organization or a media outlet today that has that sort of esteem within the organization as well as the personality to obviously take that on?
Apparently not. I actually wrote about this even before Trump came along back in 2012, right after the election. Mm-hmm. I wrote a piece for a magazine called, It's Time to Confront the Crackpots. I had no idea how many there were, but the model was, and this is important because back in the 1960s, this was a defining moment for the conservative movement. The left had their defining moment, I think, in the late 1940s, which is you draw the line and you say, we may be anti-communist, but the John Birch Society, the Ku Klux Klan, are not part of our movement, and he excommunicated the Birchers. In the way that on the left, the Democrats, like the Americans for Democratic Action, expelled the communists from the movement. But these were clarifying moments. Mm-hmm. But there are no more gatekeepers. There's no one else with this kind of clout. Now, there were, in theory, on Earth 2.0, there's the possibility that people in the conservative media could have drawn this line. you know, that Rush Limbaugh early on, if he would have said, we're not going to go in this particular direction, or some others. Yeah. But of course, they didn't for reasons of their own. But I think that's where we're at right now, is that there is no Buckley. There is no successor to Buckley. And as a result, the crackpots, the extremists, the conspiracy theorists, the racists, the anti-Semites, the paranoid fringe folks, the people who had been pushed to the outside, have now re-entered the conservative movement. If they're not mainstream, they have been empowered by these developments. I think that the Trump and his campaign, with a wink and a nod, basically gave them a certain amount of traction, and I don't know how they're going to be expelled.
Talk a bit about the role that's played by, you call it right media, the populist media, the Steve Bannons, the Breitbarts, the InfoWars, WND.com and such. What role have they played in shaping this moment that we're all sharing? And what role do they play in shaping the reactions of political office holders on the right and, you know, other conservative leaders who might otherwise perhaps take a stand against this movement?
Well, that's still playing out in real time right now, how they're doing it. In the book, I tried to identify certain key moments where there are key turning points, and there are a number, and we could probably disagree about some of them. But one of the key moments was when the Drudge Report. Are you familiar with the Drudge Report? You know, it's an aggregating website that is essentially the assignment editor for most conservative media. I would say that for the last 20 years, you know, almost every conservative talk show host in America starts the day by looking at the Drudge Report. Sometime within the last decade, I would say before 2009, Drudge started linking to Alex Jones and InfoWars. And Alex Jones and InfoWars is not your garden variety conspiracy theorist. I mean, this is a guy who's not just a 9/11 truther. He will spread stories about the Sandy Hook massacre of all those children being staged, false flag events. I mean, he's beyond the fringes of right-wing conspiracy thinking. I mean, bizarre. There's almost no crime that's occurred that he does not have a conspiracy theory that either the government's behind it or it's a false flag, whatever. Including you know, the Boston Marathon, et cetera. So Drudge starts linking to him, which injects that kind of paranoid conspiracy theory into the bloodstream. Donald Trump comes on the scene. Donald Trump launches his campaign by pushing the conspiracy theory of his campaign, which is the birther theory, right? That the first African American president of the United States was really not born in the United States, and gets away with that, by the way. But Donald Trump went on Alex Jones's show, and the week after he's elected president of the United States, he calls Alex Jones and says, "Thank you for your support. I'll come back on your show sometime." So you've taken somebody who peddles the worst weapons-grade nut job theories. They're brought into the conservative media, they're empowered, and then play a role in a presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, that's slightly separate from, you know, the Bannons and the Breitbarts. Yeah. There's been studies showing that, and these guys are very heavily funded by the Mercer family. You folks that are still focused on the Koch brothers, it's not the Koch brothers anymore, it's the Mercers. And they are weaponizing these groups. Breitbart sits in the middle of this right-wing ecosystem, and it had a tremendous effect on pushing the Republican Party, I won't even say to the right, but towards Trump, changing the climate, beating up on Fox News to the point where they had to roll over. Yeah. You know, some people forget that Fox News was originally not necessarily pro-Trump, but Breitbart and others beat on them and beat on them and beat on them that if you dissent from Trumpism, then you're for open borders, or you're a rhino, or you're a sellout, and eventually they came on board.
A rhino, Republican in name only.
But I think what we're finding out now, you know, in terms of how the right lost its mind, mm-hmm. that even Donald Trump is discovering that he can't control some of these forces that he's released, because you set the fire and then you can't control. And I think they're finding this because, of course, now Bannon and Breitbart are out there targeting other Republicans, including criticizing the president. But they play a very significant role.
A question from the audience, and I think this is a perfect segue into this. Please discuss the role of evangelicals in their support for Donald Trump, and has he delivered for them?
When I sat down to write this book, understand that, you know, I'd lived through this soul-crushing slog of 2015 and 2016. And I sat down because I knew what I was going to say about the conservative media and, you know, try to break things down. But the one chapter that I knew I was going to have a really hard time writing was the chapter, What Happened to the Christians? How did the evangelical Christians decide that they were going to support Donald Trump? You know, what was it about Donald Trump that these leaders, these Christian leaders, you know, thought they looked at him and they went, you know, he's the man we want to be president of the United States. I still find that to be absolutely remarkable. I find it to be stunning. And I think one of the most remarkable numbers, and I think I have it in the book, is the flip in the polls that, you know, not that long ago, if you would have asked, so does an immoral personal life, does it affect someone's ability to be in public life? You know, evangelical Christians overwhelmingly said, well, of course it does. You don't have somebody who is immoral. I mean, this is the character counts thing. Remember when Bill Clinton was around and character mattered? I would say 70% of evangelicals said that, yes, your personal character affected your ability to be in public life. Today, one of the demographic groups that thinks that the least are evangelical Christians. In the era of Trump, evangelical Christians are among the least thinking that personal morality and character affects your ability to be in office, which is amazing when you think about it. I think in that particular case, it was this binary choice to go back to, this sense that no matter that everything is at stake, this apocalyptic vision that if Hillary Clinton was elected, she would come for our religious liberties. I think it's hard to overstate how big an issue. I think that was beneath the radar screen for a lot of folks, this idea that the Christians felt they were under siege, that there was a war on Christianity, that the individual rights were under siege, and that no matter how bad Trump was, there was a chance that he might be the champion, that even as a sinner, even as somebody who actually – do you remember the time he was actually asked, have you ever asked God for forgiveness? This is in front of a crowd of evangelical Christians. Donald Trump has asked, have you ever asked God for forgiveness? And Trump's answer was basically, no, never once, ever. And you'd think that that would be the moment where the evangelical Christians would go, okay, you're really not one of us, are you? You know, I mean, have you ever said our Father or anything? But they didn't. And then the second part of that question was, has he delivered for them? They think he has. They think, and they've made that calculation, that they're willing to swallow all of this other behavior because he is going to give them certain things when it comes to contraception, abortion, and religious liberty. So I don't think you'll see any erosion of support there.
Russian human rights activist Garry Kasparov came to the Commonwealth Club earlier this year. He said, we're lucky it was Donald Trump who showed us the weakness of our political system. And his argument was because Trump basically doesn't have really much of an agenda other than self-enrichment. His team doesn't know what they're doing, so they're not able to get stuff passed very well. And in other words, we're in better shape that it was Donald Trump doing this than if we had elected like a devious politician like Frank Underwood of House of Cards. What do you think about that?
That's interesting. And I actually spent time with Garry on this particular issue. Mm-hmm. Garry also understands the role of propaganda. He was the one who explained to me, and I quote his tweet, which is that the point of lies, propaganda, is not to convince you necessarily of the truth of those lies. It is to attack your critical sensibility. It's an attack on truth itself to get you to the point where you no longer know what's true or necessarily care about truth. This was a really an insight into how authoritarians use false information. So he understands that. He also understands something that a lot of Americans don't understand, mm-hmm. is that our institutions are more fragile than we thought. I do believe, and I certainly was one of those that thought that because America was exceptional, that somehow it was inevitable that our democratic norms were going to be respected. And I think that's part of the shock of the Trump era, to realize that we are not immune to history, that the history of democracies is often the history of the decline of democracies, yeah. And that there's no necessarily reason why we would be exempt. The other thing that Trump has exposed to a lot of us is to understand that our system of checks and balances, which we actually used to teach in school, back when we used to teach civics, that the system of checks and balances is actually kind of a metaphor as opposed to a hard and fast thing. That our system of government is kind of based, and this is something else he said,
yeah.
That it's like an honor system. That in many ways the president is above the law. And the entire constitutional structure is based on the presumption that you have honorable people in office, that you have an honorable person in the presidency. So what happens if you don't have an honorable person in the presidency? What happens if you have somebody who has no respect for the rule of law and the separation of powers or the truth? And that's kind of the shock. So I take his point, but I would turn it around and say, and I often say this, is that I want to, I am not bothered by Donald Trump as much as you might think, because he is who he is. I want to almost turn the focus around to us. You know, from we're all like fixated looking at him. I want to turn it back on us and what his rise says about us, so that Donald Trump doesn't come in and destroy our democracy. There's something wrong with our democracy that he's there. There's something fundamentally wrong in our culture that we would think that electing a reality TV star to this position, knowing everything that we know about him, to it. And I would like to, and we have really interesting discussions on this issue of how resilient is our system.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect the people who say our institutions are standing up to him and are being resilient. On the other hand, I do think the impact that he's going to have on the culture, the coarsening effect on the culture, what he's done to the way that we discuss and think about issues, I think that damage is going to be with us for a very, very long time. And that's damage to the democratic system. Hey, look, democracy cannot survive if there's not a respect for facts and truth. And we have a president in his universe that is working overtime to destroy our respect for facts and truth. And not even we Americans are immune to that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Another member of your, I guess, smaller than expected tribe of conservatives, David Frum, was on the Bill Maher program on HBO just shortly before the election, and he was trying to make that case about institutions.
Right.
And he was saying, look, these institutions, you need to be defending them.
Right.
Because they might be all that stands in your way. And David Frum is, I guess, exiled to the same island as you right now.
Well, David Frum, in all fairness, was exiled a long time before me. He was cast out. I mean, the conservative movement has been very effective, and I'm sure this happens on the left as well. But
we're in the Bay Area; it does.
Well, I have this box that I will call not my problem right now. So you know, whatever's happening with your crazy uncles is your problem. So David Frum was excommunicated some years ago. And I've had conversations with him. I said that I apologize for not having seen what you saw when you saw it, because he did see many of these things.
Someone in the audience asks, is there anything Trump could do that would cause the right-wing media, the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and others, to abandon him?
That's an interesting question. I think it's very difficult because, you know, right now this is the business model of of conservative talk, which is you are the Trump defenders. You are. I actually was on a show with one of the talk shows, not one of those two guys, who basically explained that his job was to make this president succeed. And I said, despite anything? So you have basically surrendered your independent judgment completely? I mean, really? I hope you're well paid for this, because that doesn't sound like a fun job. I suppose there are some things, but it's hard to imagine. I was wondering what they would say about his negotiations with Chuck and Nancy, but they managed to make that pivot pretty easily. Mm-hmm. If he abandons his hard line on immigration, he might lose the Ann Coulters, but I don't know there's anything that he could do to lose Sean Hannity, who has basically just turned himself into a gushing fanboy.
You do have a comment about Sean Hannity. I'm wondering if I can get you into saying him. You've referred to his intelligence in a certain way.
No, I've referred to his effect on my intelligence.
Okay.
And that I actually was driving to a dinner with a reporter and tuned on Sean Hannity, and I walked in the door, and one of the first things I said was I was just listening to Sean Hannity, and I feel that I get dumber every minute I listen to him.
Someone says, I got here late. Who is the Mercer family? Let's use that as an opportunity. Who are the folks who are bankrolling a lot of these movements and the organizations, the media outlets?
Yeah, the Mercers are billionaires, Robert and his daughter, Rebecca Mercer, and they are relatively recent players. They weren't – a lot of the things that we're talking about were not around even a few years ago. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of things have happened with a great deal of speed and a lack of understanding. But they're for whatever reason, they have allied themselves with Steve Bannon and the Breitbart folks and are writing out checks in the tens of millions of dollars to fund many of these things. Clearly will play a major role in, say, primarying rational Republicans who dare to buck Donald Trump. Whereas the Koch brothers, I think, you know, whether you like them or not, they actually have a pretty well-developed philosophy of what they believe in. The Mercers seem to have bought into this sort of chaos theory of going along with what Bannon is doing.
Speaking of which, where are the Koch brothers in terms of their posture towards Trump? Are they supporting, avoiding?
They avoided him. I don't think that they supported him during the campaign, but I think that they've made the calculation that they will work with him on the agenda. I think that they will probably play a significant role in pushing for tax reform legislation.
And that leads into another great question. Do you like any of the policies that Trump is trying to implement? I mean, whether it's tax policy or health care or anything like that.
Well, you know, this is the hard part for a contrarian conservative, because there will be moments where you'll agree with him on certain issues. I tend to agree with him on a lot of judicial issues. Mm-hmm. I did support his nomination for Supreme Court of Neil Gorsuch. I'm having a hard time understanding the policymaking procedures they're going through on health care. I mean, I remember back in 2009 when Obamacare was being passed, the big mantra, of course, among conservatives was that it was being done too quickly. It was being rammed through. We didn't know what was in it. Well, that seems like almost laughable now, since the Republicans were about to vote on a bill that had been released a day before. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows what was in the bill. But more importantly, nobody knows how it affects things in the real world. There's a reason why we have never unraveled a social program like that, you know, once it has been in place. I don't know that the Trump administration – first of all, Donald Trump does not care about policy. Donald Trump is a man without principle, without any curiosity about policy. I think he's indifferent to the effects of his policies. He just wants a win. I mean, it's not that hard. It's not that complicated. He just wants that signing ceremony where he can claim a win, even if it means that millions of people's lives will be disrupted, even if it will mean that there are unintended consequences. Now, there's a brand of conservatism which says, let's take the world as it is, try to do no harm, understand what the effect on the ground will be. I don't sense that that's what we're seeing right now, because I sense there's a lot of legislation that's been on the shelves for a long time, including the tax bill,
yeah.
which is an example of zombie conservatism, which is we were for this in 1982. Therefore, even though the world has fundamentally changed, we're going to come up with the exact same answer in 2017 that we came up in 1982. So I'm not sure that these are well thought through or principled.
Okay. There are a couple of questions here I'm going to merge together because they're pretty much kind of asking the same thing. And it tags on what you were just talking about Trump wanting a win.
Yeah.
And it, the questions are, is Trump the leader of the Republican Party or is he pulling folks away from both parties? Is his loyalty, you know, Ronald Reagan would do stuff right. for the Republican Party.
Right.
Donald Trump is more likely about Donald Trump, correct?
He's very much about Donald Trump. And I think this is dawning on Republicans who thought that they were going to be able to domesticate him in some way, and they're not. It is all about Donald Trump. If that means throwing his fellow Republicans under the bus, he will do that. He actually is in a unique position because of the nature of his coalition, that he did draw a non-traditional Republican vote.
Yeah.
And it's a real challenge to the Democrats, who I don't think have figured out how do you get back those Trump voters. How do you get back, you know, the rural blue-collar voters in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, who voted for maybe Barack Obama twice and then voted for Donald Trump? I think there was always that fear among Republicans that we have to appease Donald Trump, otherwise he might become a third-party candidate. I think there's still kind of that anxiety that he could go rogue and go his own way.
If Donald Trump had not won in 2016, say he got the nomination, but he did not win in November, what would be your take on the Republican Party's state of its conservative health, of its ability to move forward with its coalition revealed to be what it is?
Well, that's what I was expecting to happen. Mm-hmm. Like most other Americans, I didn't think he would win. I thought that then there was going to be this real serious period of introspection. After Romney lost to Obama, a member of the Republican Party had an autopsy. I think this time they would need an exorcism. I still think they need an exorcism to be able to ask, you know, first of all, how did this happen? How did he win the nomination? What does this say about us as a party?
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think there was that looking around going, I thought I understood what the party was about. I mean, I thought what the movement was about. Obviously, we didn't. And I'm not alone in that. Did not know. So how deep was this dysfunction? And I think that one of the things we realize is that Donald Trump was a symptom, not just a cause. I mean, he was a symptom that this dysfunction of the Republican Party and the conservative movement was a pre-existing condition. And it would have been there even had he lost.
Even if he had not run at all, that still would have been there?
Well, it obviously was there.
Yeah.
And obviously went back a lot deeper. One of the first questions, one reason I wrote this book was I wanted to figure out for myself what the hell just happened. And whether or not this was a black swan event, whether you just had this weird moment where Donald Trump parachutes into an otherwise healthy movement and takes it over, and it was a, you know, or whether or not there was continuity, you know, there was a continuity or discontinuity. I think I started thinking that, well, it was clearly just a radical break, that Donald Trump had nothing to do with what the Republican Party had been standing for and what was going on. And I changed my mind about that because I think the dysfunction runs too deep. And you go back 4 years earlier. I mean, this is a party that has had its share of crackpots before. I mean, in 2012, remember in the presidential race, Michelle Bachmann was the front runner for a while, and Newt Gingrich was the front runner for a while, and Herman Cain was the front runner for a while. You had odd candidates like Sharon Engel running for Senate in Nevada, or there's so many of them. You know, Todd Akin who was running, and clearly, what I had thought was going to happen was that we were going to manage the fringes. That the center would hold, that somehow the rational decision would be made, and it wasn't. But that doesn't mean that we didn't have that problem out there for a long time. And I think what had happened was that the Republican Party, as I wrote over the weekend, has been outsourcing its thought leadership to the loudmouth drunk at the end of the bar for a long time. And it had cranked up this outrage machine, which I call in the book the perpetual outrage machine. Yeah. We are always outraged all the time, and we know what we're against, but we didn't know what we were for anymore. And I think that was Donald Trump came in and he exploited that. He didn't create that. But even without Donald Trump, you had that sort of growing just industry of total outrage and opposition without much constructive thinking.
I want to step back a bit and go into populism. When I was talking about your book with a colleague, their reply was, but populism is a good thing. Why is this bad? You make the case very clearly in the book, your thoughts on populism and why it's a dangerous thing, and also why specifically someone from your political point of view would see problems with it. So for the sake of explaining this, why would you please?
Well, you know, part of it is what does populism mean? It's mm-hmm. like somebody asked me earlier this morning about, you know, democratic values. Okay, well, what exactly are we talking about? Is populism acting in the public interest? Then it is clearly a good thing. Yeah. Is populism playing on resentments and class warfare? Is it the desire that, you know, if we just want something, we should be able to impose it on others? So, you know, part of that is understanding what the words mean. But I think that my understanding of conservatism was that it was a careful balance. It was ordered liberty. It was suspicious of an authoritarian government, but it was also suspicious of, you know, populist insurgency, mm-hmm. You know, particularly of the you know, hyper-nationalist nativist brand. And I don't, are there populist elements that ought to be incorporated into our politics? Absolutely. Did we ignore too many Americans? I think that we did. Yeah. Are some of those grievances legitimate? I think they are. And I think we have to sort of unpackage some of the legitimate grievances from the way that they're exploited. I mean, simply because you have an irresponsible demagogue who comes in and exploits grievances doesn't mean that there aren't actual grievances. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we didn't have a government and a quote-unquote elite that had not gotten out of touch with how actual people live in the real world.
As you said, you're talking about conservatives and the Republican Party. We see similar stuff going on with the left, with it being pulled further and further to the yeah. left. Are we just in for now an extended period of populist revival, or do you think they will be that the center, if you will, in each party will kind of find a way to address enough of the issues so that they stem the tide, if you will?
I'm not sure that it's all populist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to be more optimistic here. I'm struggling to be.
Okay.
I do sense that we are pulling further and further apart tribally, whatever the identity. Mm-hmm. And I think the mistake sometimes that I'll say guys like you and me, but I actually mean me, we'll make is thinking that American politics is about ideas, issues, accomplishments, and those type of things, when, in fact, you get the sense sometimes that American politics is all about attitude. It's all about tribal identity. And that can shift. It can be populist. It can be nationalist. It can be nativist. Is nativist necessarily mean populist? Does it necessarily mean, you know, mm-hmm. those things? What is the bundle? But our politics being us versus them, you know, red versus blue, is becoming more intense. And part of the problem is that all of the weight, the loudest voices, are incentivized to pull further and further away. I mean, you come to events like this, and you realize how vital the center is, how center-right and center-left can talk with one another. I think that you talk about how about a politics of a little bit of moderation, openness, inclusion, modesty, and people will think, yeah, well, try to fill a rally hall with that. Try to get a million clicks for your website. Go moderation, you know. I'm torn because I think there's this tremendous appetite to have a conversation across the lines, but the economic and the political incentives seem to be empowering the most bombastic, obnoxious voices on either side.
not only might it not be as exciting to talk about compromise and understanding the other side and stuff like that, but you have, for lack of a better term, the internet trolls
right.
who attack.
And oh, yeah.
You've been the victim of this. You know, do you fear, because it's not just you, it's folks quite across the society who are getting attacked like this. Do you fear that, I mean, is this all noise, or do you think it could become lethal at some point?
The culture of intimidation and bullying is very real, mm-hmm. and it plays a significant role in our politics. There's no question about it. The chapter of the book is, I think it's called Trolls and Flying Monkeys, which is basically on the right, anyone that criticized Trump, they would release the internet trolls and what I call the flying monkeys, the attacks, and how bitter and vicious they were. And there are people who are genuinely concerned. Look, you can see that it can become lethal on both sides here, that it can become lethal. That is part of it. So I understand why people shut up. Mm-hmm. I do understand why if you are in conservative media, you're going to be very reluctant to do it. I would be glad to share my Twitter feed with anybody to see what reaction I get. I don't care anymore, but I can certainly imagine they do. I do tell a story in the book. The one night, it was in May of 2016, and I was on Megyn Kelly's show when she was still on Fox. And by this point, I think Trump had pretty much nailed it down. And she wanted to know, so why are you not getting on board? Everybody else is getting on board. And I gave my little thing about how, you know, I didn't think that I wanted to give him the nuclear codes. And left. And interestingly enough, Fox posted online the person who was on right before me and the person who was on right after me, but never posted what I said. But somebody else did. But check the Twitter feed. Before I got to my car, there were probably 1,000 responses. And because if you know how Twitter works, if somebody sends something to, we're both on. So I got to see what Megyn Kelly was getting for me being on. And it was the most remarkable thing. You want to talk about, you know, your hour of pure, raw hatred out there. I had a chance to ask her more recently. I said, do you read your Twitter feed? Do you know what people are saying? And she goes, no, I have other people do that. I said, well, that's a smart decision because you do not want to know how ugly it is. And I'm always fascinated by the question, does this just expose something that was out there that we just never knew? Or does it actually create it because that it encourages otherwise normal, rational human beings in anonymity to express thoughts and make threats that they would never actually make otherwise? But this is very real. And so when people say, well, why will Republicans not stand up against Donald Trump? I mean, I wish they were, but I also understand that a lot of them will say it's just not worth it. I don't want to have to go through it. I don't want to put my family through it. I don't want to look at it. I don't want to have to push back.
Yeah, I mean, you have situations where parents who are the targets of this will have people sending them photos of their kids. You know, I know how their kid gets to school, and you know, images of them if they're Jewish, you know, connected with the Holocaust. I mean, it's really vicious stuff.
It is vicious stuff, and it can get very, very personal. I tell the story very early on. I had never heard the phrase cuckservative before this campaign. You know the term cuckservative? It's an alt-right thing. And by the way, I know the alt-right is just a euphemism for white nationalists and anti-Semites. But it was that if you were not a pro-Trump conservative, you were a cuck. It's a very racially loaded term, basically suggesting that you were like a cuckold. That you were watching your nation being, you know, raped by our black president or something. I don't know. But one of the tweets that I got early on was a picture, my head superimposed into a gas chamber with Donald Trump pressing the gas button. And if you look very closely on it, it was from a website, I think it was the Daily Stormer, which was basically a neo-Nazi website, which enabled people to make these things. So I was not the only one that had it. This became a popular thing where the Daily Stormer decided, so you can put anyone you want in a gas chamber to be gassed by Donald Trump. So I would say there were probably thousands of people that got similar things like this. And I won't say that I laugh that off because there's nothing funny about it. But I can certainly imagine how people would be intimidated by it.
Let's talk about you as a radio host for 23 years. And in your book, you also put yourself in the focus there. And you kind of say, well, what part did I play in what happened? Talk a bit about that.
Well, that's the other thing is, I was a conservative talk show host. In the state of Wisconsin,
the number one in the state
for two decades. So I was part of the conservative movement, and they have to say, okay, so did I contribute to this? So at the end of this day, when I see the state of Wisconsin goes for Donald Trump, and many of the people that I had worked with and who had listened to me decided they were going to vote for him, kind of the where did you go wrong type thing. And I don't there are a lot of distinctions need to be made. I mean, I'm not Sean Hannity. I didn't obviously I spent a year and a half of my life doing everything possible to not elect Donald Trump. But on the other hand, you do have to ask yourself, what did you contribute? And I think it's fair to say that I was part of the media ecosystem that contributed to the alternative reality media that we created, that we had succeeded in delegitimizing the mainstream media. Any conservative in America will criticize the media for being biased. And I think some of that's legitimate. But there came a point where you realize that you had delegitimized all news, that you had turned, instead of just being the other side of the story, that we had created this hermetically sealed bubble, echo chamber, whatever term you want to use, that became impenetrable. And when I really realized this was when I was getting this flood of what we now call fake news. Well, the president has seized on this propaganda information. For years, I would get stuff, and you named a couple of these websites, WorldNet Daily. Yeah. For years, I would push back with the audience and say, this is not true. This is bogus. And up until I would say the end of 2015, no, actually probably the beginning of 2016, people would go, okay, well, thank you for pointing this out that this is false. But as 2016 went along, it became harder and harder. First of all, the volume was much more intense. There were so many more websites. There were so many more Facebook feeds. And now we're finding out that many of them may have been generated by the Russians, for all that we know. I mean, if you've seen the story on the front page of the New York Times this morning, if you haven't, it's extraordinary the way in which the Russians weaponized many of these really racially divisive images to push. And those were the kinds of things that were coming over my transom on a regular basis. And I found that when I say, well, this did not happen because, and then I would cite a source, a fact-based source. But instead of saying thank you, they would say, well, that's just the liberal news media. That's just liberal hacks. And well, what about this? Well, that's, and realize that outside, if it came from outside the bubble, you could not penetrate. You could not falsify. So what had happened was I'd spent 20 years thinking that we were developing this savvy audience that could have a different point of view, but we had destroyed their immunity to false information. We could not break through all of that, and that's disturbing. Mm-hmm. The other biggest failing, I think, and I contribute to this, I'll fess up, that we did underestimate the bigots among us. We knew there were the fringe characters, and you would hear things, you'd roll your eyes, but you figure we're on the same side. We agree 80% of the time, so I'm not going to confront all of this. And I think that there was a good deal of denial about that. And, the drunk at the end of the bar turned out not to be as marginal a figure as we thought.
We only got about 10 minutes left, so I want to try to get through more of these questions. A couple of questions are on the gerrymandering case in Wisconsin that is before the U.S. Supreme Court. Some people are saying this could be potentially, dramatic shift if they, depending on how the Supreme Court rules. What are your thoughts on this?
They're complicated, actually, because I do think that one of the real problems in our democracy has been the fact that there are no more competitive districts, that the system looks like it has been rigged. But just a little bit of background. One of the things, and I'm not defending this, the gerrymandering, because I actually know some of the people that were responsible for it, and they're very good at doing what they were doing, and they knew what they were doing. So, I mean, this didn't just happen. But one of the things that's also happened is we've been sorting ourselves out geographically. There's a book called The Big Sort by Bill Bishop. And what he points out is that it's not just the gerrymandering. We have, as a people, not only created intellectual ghettos online, we are sorting ourselves out geographically. So, say, in Wisconsin, one of the reasons why the numbers look so skewed is that the very Democratic areas in Wisconsin are intensely Democratic. You will have assembly districts that will have 90% Democratic votes, but they will be right next door to Republican areas that have gotten much more Republican. The blue is much more blue, the red is much more red, so that you have this disconnect so that, yes, the Democrats get tons and tons of votes, but they will be in Madison and Milwaukee. In order to draw the lines, you'd almost have to make them like the spokes of a wheel. One of the reasons the lines have been drawn the way they've been drawn is been to maximize minority representation. So there's the unintended consequence, and I understand this is kind of technical here, but we're not going to solve the problem of our sorting out simply by dealing with gerrymandering. And one point of that, look at the map just on states, blue states, red states. The United States Senate is not gerrymandered. Governorships are not gerrymandered. And I think that we're going to have to find some way to deal with that as well. I would not be surprised if Wisconsin lost that lawsuit, and I'm not sure that it's a bad thing. But I don't know what the remedy is, and I don't know that the courts. I think this is what the Supreme Court justices are wrestling with. They recognize that the Wisconsin case is very extreme, but they also recognize that if you strike that down, you've now, you know, okay, so what's your better idea? And I'm not sure what you do.
Yeah. Here in California, of course, we took the district drawing capabilities away from the legislature and put it in the hands of a commission. The state has, if anything, become bluer, and its right. representation has become bluer. Well, that will be interesting to watch. Someone asks if the preoccupation with Trump's ties to Russia is diverting both his attention away from, you know, pushing a policy agenda, as well as just not kind of taking everyone's eye off the ball, if you will, of the important things. How closely do you follow the Russia thing? Do you think that's a sideline, or do you think that's the ultimate story about Donald Trump?
It could be the ultimate story about Donald Trump. Really? It's clearly distracting him a great deal. He's clearly obsessed about it. He probably should be obsessed about it because you have an independent prosecutor who is going to find out pretty much everything about his finances. And if you are somebody who lies so casually and easily as Donald Trump, you will discover how dangerous it is to lie to a federal prosecutor or a special prosecutor. I also think that the story, and this I will admit to being very frustrated about this, that I'm old enough to remember when Republicans would actually have taken a Russian attack on our democracy as a really big deal. You want to talk about the corruption of Trumpism. You know, all of these, you know, former conservative Republicans who 5 minutes ago recognized what a geopolitical threat Vladimir Putin represented, now trying to poo-poo the hacking of our democracy, in effect. This is a very big deal, and I ought to disclose at this point that I'm on the advisory board of the Committee to Investigate Russia, which was, if you've seen that Morgan Freeman video, it's been put together. Speaking of, like, working across strange bedfellows, Rob Reiner is the guy that put it together and asked whether I would add my name along with David Frum to that. And I said, well, you know, you and I probably don't agree on anything, but this is a moment where this is an issue of patriotic Americans should care about this a great deal. I'm not going to prejudge what the investigation is going to discover, but this is you sort of can't imagine Reagan Republicans going, so the Russians attacked us? Who cares?
Do you think Trump would ever resign? What might make him or what might take him over the edge?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
Being a pathological narcissist is a problem. It's hard for me to imagine someone like Donald Trump, whose entire identity is built around winning, mm-hmm. acknowledging that he's losing and quitting. So I have a very hard time that you would have objective circumstances where it became impossible for him to continue or govern, but that he would not recognize.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something people have to realize. Richard Nixon resigned only after Barry Goldwater and other Republican members of the U.S. Senate went to see him and said to him, you need to go. It's got to be the Republican Party, but who in the Republican Party now has that ability? Who's the Goldwater now? Who's the James Buckley who would go and say that to him now? He would go to war with them. So I don't know what it would be. Mm. And again, we don't know where this Mueller investigation is going to go.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for just one last question. So I'm going to take this from the audience, and it is, rate Donald Trump's chances of being reelected in 2020.
Better than you think. Remember, you have to beat somebody with somebody. I hope that the Democrats recognize that this is not a tap-in. You know, in our politics, what did we see in 2016? The binary choice. So I could certainly imagine a circumstance where the opposition overplays its hand, the president accomplishes nothing but runs against Hollywood, the liberal news media, plays these culturally divisive issues. I mean, here's a president. I mean, you know why he's doing the NFL stuff. I mean, this is like catnip to his base. It doesn't matter whether he's created any jobs, whether he's repealed Obamacare, as long as he can divide the country on whether you stand or kneel for the national anthem. But also, I really do think that if the Democrats nominate somebody who is too extreme, that you're going to see almost the exact same pattern of votes. Now, I'm not saying I want to see him get two terms. He might not want to run for a second term. But don't underestimate that all of the things we've been talking about, the divisions, the media ecosystem, the fact that Democrats have proven their ability to overplay their hand. And one of the stories that I tell in Wisconsin, you know, Wisconsin was a Democratic state. It is now solidly Republican, not because the Republicans there are necessarily brilliant. It's because the Democrats and the left overplayed their hand to the point where they alienated many people in the center. Scott Walker was losing that collective bargaining fight up until very late in the game, when the protesters would disrupt Special Olympics events, when they protested at his parents' house, where his elderly, you know, their elderly parents live, and basically there was a backlash. If there is that kind of overreach that causes a backlash for Trump, he could exploit that. Now, the fact that his approval ratings are as terrible as they are might give you hope. But remember what his approval ratings were right before the election. This was an election which basically 60% of the American public disliked him, recognized that he did not have the qualifications to be president, did not think that he was honest, and yet somehow he was elected. So I would not say that despite the fact that his presidency has been absolutely shambolic, that he cannot be reelected.
Well, our thanks to Charlie Sykes, author of the new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, for our conversation today. We also thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the internet. Finally, we wish to remind you that Charlie Sykes will be signing copies of his book for sale right outside of this room. And I'm John Zipperer. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is over. Charlie, thank you very much.